Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is focused on an extensive and pretty provocative legal argument.
Yeah, it really is.
We are not discussing simple bureaucratic inefficiency or, you know, typical administrative errors. We are diving into a comprehensive constitutional indictment, a formal, very detailed legal critique leveled against Child Protective Services, specifically focusing on the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families, or DCF.
That's absolutely right. The source material we're working with, it goes far beyond the usual complaints you hear about the foster care system.
Yeah.
This is an intense, deep legal analysis arguing that these agencies are not merely flawed in how they operate, but are actually void in principle.
Void in principle.
Yes.
Yeah.
The central assertion is that they lack lawful authority from their very inception. Basically, operating outside the constitutional delegation of power granted by the people.
So, if you are listening today, our mission statement for you is to provide a clear roadmap. We want you to understand the core legal, constitutional, and importantly, financial mechanisms underpinning this radical claim. The claim that CPS agencies operate, in effect, outside the bounds of legitimate delegated government power.
And the critique starts right at the beginning, doesn't it? With the theory of government itself.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this. We're starting with the foundational theoretical claim. The absolute nullity of CPS.
Yeah, the foundational principle here, and this is drawn from thinkers like Blackstone, Locke, Jefferson, it's that civil government is not a sovereign entity unto itself. Its sole legitimate end is to secure the unalienable, natural, inherent rights of the people. That's the basis of this delegated trust idea.
Right. So government is a delegated and fiduciary trust. It's a servant, not the master. And if the government or, you know, any part of its apparatus exceeds that charge, if it operates outside the specific powers granted to it by the people, it fundamentally severs its constitutional tether. And according to this critique, it becomes an instrument of oppression.
And the consequence of that severance is critical. The source relies heavily on maxims like no human laws are valid if contrary to natural law. So the moment an agency steps outside the bounds of that constitutionally delegated trust, its actions are, well, they're invalid.
Okay. This brings us to a dense but really crucial legal term that we probably need to spend a moment on. Void ab initio.
Right. Void ab initio. If an institution or an action is taken without a clear constitutional foundation, it is void ab initio. It translates directly to void from the beginning. It's a legal nullity from the instant it was created.
So not just wrong, but legally non-existent from the start.
Exactly. And this wasn't just some philosophical idea. Early American courts, you know, cases like Van Horn's Lessee v. Dorrance, confirmed this. The power of the legislature stops short of constitutional usurpation. If the government tries to delegate or exercise a power that the people never actually gave it, the resulting action or agency simply doesn't exist in the eyes of the law.
Wow. Okay, so if the underlying foundation is missing, the entire structure built upon it just collapses, legally speaking. If this critique holds, that means every action taken by the agency, every removal, every court filing would be built on legally non-existent grounds.
Precisely. And the critique emphasizes that the source of all legitimate power resides exclusively in the people. Article V of the Massachusetts Constitution makes this explicit. Officials are merely substitutes and agents.
Substitutes and agents, not rulers.
And the 10th Amendment reminds us, any power not expressly delegated to the federal government is reserved to the states, or, crucially, to the people themselves. The critique argues that this power, the power over private familial life, was never delegated away by the people. So if DCF is exercising it, it's using a power the people kept for themselves.
This analysis then zeroes in on the most fundamental relationship the state interferes with, the parent-child relationship.
Yes. The source asserts that parental authority isn't some state-granted privilege. It's a natural right, a sacred trust even, that precedes the existence of the state itself. It exists inherently.
It's protected by the foundational documents, not created by them.
Exactly.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because the critique argues the state has adopted a legal philosophy that fundamentally twists this natural right. The state intervenes under this doctrine of parens patria, parent of the nation.
Yes. And historically, parens patria was actually a pretty limited necessary function. You know, think of it as the state needing to handle estates or guardianship for actual orphans, kids whose parents had died, or individuals who were legally incapacitated.
A narrow role.
Yeah.
Protective, administrative.
Right. But the source argues that the modern use of parens patria has just ballooned. It's transformed into something far more insidious, according to this view.
How so?
The critique compares it to the Roman imperial concept of patria potestas, which literally meant father's power, but ultimately implied the state absorbing all familial authority. Under that Roman model, the state basically became the ultimate legal authority over the family unit.
Okay, I see the parallel.
So the legal analysis claims that when CPS intervenes based on, say, disagreements over homeschooling or maybe medical care choices, things that aren't immediate, provable harm parental rights get downgraded. They go from being an unalienable natural right to being more like a revocable license, contingent on continuous bureaucratic approval.
That is a critical conceptual shift, isn't it? We move from a republic where the government secures pre-existing rights to an administrative state where the government licenses those rights and can revoke them if you don't conform to its subjective standards. The critique actually labels this administrative despotism.
And that transformation from the limited protector of true orphans to the subjective judge of proper parenting, that's the key structural flaw that, according to the source, renders the entire operation null from the start.
Okay, so moving from that constitutional theory of nullity, the critique next argues that this specific function regulating custody and domestic relations was never lawfully delegated to Congress in the first place.
Right, this is a very strict interpretation of federal power. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution lists the powers given to Congress. And as James Madison pointed out in Federalist No. 45, these powers are supposed to be few and defined.
And child custody, parental rights, domestic relations, they're just not on that list.
They're not. So under the 10th Amendment, that power is reserved, either to the states or, as the critique emphasizes, ultimately to the people. So the federal government attempting to legislate in this area is, therefore, an ultra vires act. It's beyond the scope of its lawful authority.
And the main federal mechanism used to fund and regulate these state agencies is Title 42 of the U.S. Code, right? Title 4E, the public health and welfare.
Yes. And here's a crucial legal point from the source that needs a bit of explanation. Title 42 has apparently never been enacted as positive law.
Okay, that sounds incredibly technical. What does that mean in practice for you listening? If Congress passed it, why isn't it binding law in the same way?
Well, when Congress codifies laws into the U.S. Code, they usually enact certain titles as positive law. That means the code itself is the law. Title 42, however, is what's called a non-positive law title. This means it's more like a compilation of statutes. The underlying statutes themselves govern, not the title code as a whole. So the source argues that this distinction means the provisions of Title 42, especially those related to health and welfare mandates, don't actually impose a binding lawful obligation on the citizenry itself. They mainly impose obligations on the state agencies that voluntarily accept the federal funding attached to them.
That's fascinating. So the entire federal engine driving CPS is built on what's essentially a non-binding legal compilation. It creates incentives for states to comply if they want the federal money, but not necessarily a direct mandate on the people.
That's the argument presented.
Yeah.
And the delegation problems don't stop there.
Right.
Even if Congress had the constitutional power, which the source flatly denies, they couldn't just hand it off to an administrative agency. There's a clear legal maxim.
Yeah.
A delegated power cannot be again delegated.
Right. You can't pass the buck on the legislative authority.
Exactly. Sir Edward Coke established this principle centuries ago. Legislative authority cannot just be transferred to unelected administrative agencies like DCF.
And the source points out that this seems to ignore the original legislative intent, too.
Precisely. The Social Security Act of 1935, which kicked off much of this federal welfare structure, actually included Section 1101 PACE. And that section explicitly disclaimed federal authority to take charge of any child over the objection of either of the parents.
So the foundational document itself recognized this limit on federal intervention in private family matters.
According to the source, yes. It seems to acknowledge that boundary.
Okay, so if their foundational documents, constitutional limits, and these old legal maxims all seem to prohibit this kind of intervention, the question becomes, were officials just acting in ignorance or were they warned? And that brings us to this shocking documentation of alleged willful trespass via ignored notices. Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, this is where the argument shifts from a theoretical flaw to potentially knowing misconduct. The source meticulously documented that between February 2024 and July 2025, 259 individually executed citizen notices were formally served upon key Massachusetts officials.
259, that's a lot. Who are we talking about?
We're talking Governor Healey, Attorney General Campbell, the DCF commissioner at the time, Simon R. Miller, and others. Top officials.
259 formal legal warnings. What exactly were these officials told in these notices?
Well, they weren't just vague complaints. They were described as meticulously crafted legal instruments. They precisely delineated the constitutional defects, the non-positive law status of Title VOE, the unlawful aggregation of power, violating the separation of powers under Article XXX of the MA Constitution.
Right, where DCF acts as investigator, prosecutor, and judge.
Exactly. And crucially, they also pointed out the lack of sovereign immunity for officers acting outside their legal bounds, citing 42 U.S.C. Section 1983.
Okay, let's pause on that last point for a second. What's the practical implication of citing 42 U.S.C. Section 1983? Why is the significant?
Well, that's the Civil Rights Act provision. It allows citizens to sue state and local government officials personally if those officials deprive them of their constitutional rights while acting under color of law. So once these state officials are formally notified that they are acting ultra vires beyond their delegated authority, the argument is they lose the shield of sovereign immunity. They could then potentially be held personally liable for damages resulting from their constitutional violations.
So they weren't just notified of a problem in theory. They were notified that they were personally exposed to legal risk if they continued. What was the demand they were given in these notices?
The demand was quite simple, yet profound. They were given 10 business days to produce a sworn affidavit. An affidavit citing the precise constitutional authority for their continued actions. Essentially, show us under oath the lawful source of your power to do this.
And the response, what happened?
Silence. Apparently no such affidavits were forthcoming. Not from the governor, not the attorney general, not any DCF officer named.
No sworn justification provided.
One reported. And the source states that under established legal principles, going back to Koch and Blackstone, non-responsiveness to a formal specific demand for justification constitutes acquiescence. It basically concedes the legal conclusions advanced in the notice.
Wow. So if the officials were formally notified of these constitutional defects, they failed to produce the constitutional authority to justify their actions under oath, and then they continued intervening, their actions, in the view of this legal critique, transition from maybe administrative error to willful trespass and knowing violation of their oath.
That's the conclusion drawn by the source. Continued action after such formal notice transforms these officers, in this view, from stewards of public trust into instrumentalities of administrative overreach, acting in knowing willful violation of the constitutional limits placed upon them.
Okay, this indictment of constitutional nullity and potentially willful trespass sets the necessary stage for the next part of the argument. Analyzing the legal predicate the agencies actually used to justify their intervention. The source details how the standard for intervention itself has been critically distorted.
Right. The common law, through historical figures like Blackstone, established a very high, very objective standard for when the state could intervene in a family. The sole legal predicate was real, tangible, and provable harm. Not just worry, but actual harm.
And what was the historical legal threshold for that harm? What did it look like?
It was corporal injury. Actual or threatened, basically demonstrable physical damage or an imminent credible risk to life or limb. It had to be objective and it required sworn proof. This high barrier was intentionally designed, the source argues, to protect the unalienable right of the parent and the family unit from arbitrary state action.
Okay, a very high bar. Yet DCF and similar agencies today operate under a much, much broader and frankly, highly subjective standard. It's outlined in Massachusetts law, MGL Chapter 119, Section 51A, as substantial risk of physical or emotional injury.
That phrase, or emotional injury, is exactly what the source identifies as the key mechanism of constitutional erosion here. This vague language, it argues, permits intervention based on subjective opinion, speculation, and disagreement with parental choices, rather than approvable injury.
So this substitution creates a massive legal loophole, doesn't it? The objective standard of corporal injury, you know, a bruise, a broken bone, something you can see improve, is replaced by subjective speculation about potential future emotional risk, which is incredibly hard to define.
Exactly. And the source argues this transforms what should be a protective mechanism into a tool for essentially social and ideological control.
And the source provides some really quite shocking illustrative examples of how this subjective standard plays out in Massachusetts. These aren't cases of obvious horrific abuse. They seem to be cases where subjective judgment completely replaced the required objective standard.
That's the claim.
Let's start with the one that, well, it genuinely strains credulity, the aesthetic judgment case.
Yeah, the source mentions a case in Worcester, MA back in 2022. A toddler was seized. And the reason given. A social worker apparently found the child's hair was too shiny.
Too shiny.
Too shiny, which led the worker to speculate about Munchausen syndrome by proxy. But there was reportedly no physical abuse, no medical evidence of abuse found later. Yet the child was removed, returned 14 days later, but only after significant legal intervention. The removal was based, essentially, on an aesthetic hunch, not provable harm.
That perfectly illustrates the problem, doesn't it? If a social worker's subjective aesthetic opinion is enough to trigger removal, then the constitutional protection of the family is functionally meaningless at that point.
That's the core of the critique. Then you have the cases involving medical dissent. In Fall River, MA, 2023, a healthy 7-year-old was reportedly removed from their parents. Why? Because the parents had filed a lawful, recognized vaccine exemption.
A legally valid exemption.
Yes, but the charge was medical neglect. Even though the child was healthy and thriving, the argument is the state was intervening not to prevent actual injury, but to enforce compliance with its preferred medical regimen.
So the state uses the subjective standard of neglect to effectively override or punish parental choices that dissent from the bureaucratic norm, even when those choices are legally protected, like using a lawful vaccine exemption.
That's how the source frames it. It also highlights how the system can end up criminalizing poverty. A Boston family in 2021 was investigated and cited for unsafe housing, the sole reason given: the limited square footage of their apartment relative to the number of children.
Just the size of the apartment.
Just the size. The source argues this effectively criminalizes economic hardship. Reportedly, no unsanitary conditions, no actual physical danger, just limited space that a caseworker subjectively deemed inadequate.
So the standard is so vague that simply being poor, even if you are providing love and basic necessities, puts you at risk, because a social worker can subjectively deem your living space or maybe even your child's appearance inadequate.
That's the danger highlighted. And finally, there are examples cited concerning ideological preference interventions. A father in Worcester County in 2022 was investigated for emotional abuse. The reason: he refused to use preferred pronouns for his biologically male child based on his deeply held religious convictions.
Again, not physical harm.
No. Again, the standard of emotional injury becomes the mechanism, the source argues, through which the state enforces ideological conformity, placing itself right in the middle of core parental decision-making about values and beliefs.
So in every one of these anecdotes, the constitutional gate, that objective corporal harm threshold, wasn't just lowered, it seems like it was completely bypassed, replaced by the subjective interpretation of bureaucratic agents.
Yes. The distortion of the standard, according to this critique, transforms DCF from a potential protector of the truly endangered into something more like a regulatory arm of the administrative state, enforcing compliance rather than preventing injury. And this distortion, this reliance on subjective standards, is apparently dramatically reflected in the statistics. When we look at the data presented from Massachusetts for fiscal year 2023, the source claims we see statistical proof that the system is overwhelmingly focused on these subjective criteria. It confirms the systemic bias identified in the constitutional critique.
Okay, so what does this all mean when we actually look at the data? Lay out the numbers for us.
The data presented is pretty staggering. Neglect allegations reportedly accounted for 73.1% of all allegations reported in FY 2023. That's nearly three quarters.
73% neglect.
Now, if we combine only the categories that might align with Blackstone's objective corporal injury threshold, that's physical abuse, reportedly 21.3%, and sexual abuse, 12.1%. They total only about 33.4%.
Okay, so that means nearly two-thirds of the entire system's engagement, all the investigations, the calls, the visits,
yeah,
it's based on subjective neglect, which, as we've just discussed, often seems to conflate poverty or dissent or maybe just poor housekeeping with actual danger.
And the gap widens even further when we look at actual removals, kids taken from their homes. The source notes that only about 6.3% of total removals are based on actual or threatened bodily injury.
Only 6.3%.
That's the figure cited. That's the crucial number, according to the critique. It demonstrates a massive institutional over-reliance on the subjective criteria for the most extreme intervention.
So let me get this straight. The state is spending millions, involving hundreds of agents, and removing children from their families in roughly 94% of cases where the objective historical standard of corporal injury is not apparently met.
That's what the numbers presented suggest. And then the question becomes, what are the outcomes of these interventions? The source argues that these interventions, often based on legally tenuous grounds, end up inflicting what's known as iatrogenic harm, that is, harm caused by the treatment or the intervention itself. The statistics cited on outcomes for kids after removal are profoundly disturbing.
We really need to process the gravity of these numbers. What does the data show happens to kids in care?
Well, nationally, foster youth reportedly experience 3 times more physical abuse and 2x the rate of sexual abuse compared to children who remain in their biological homes, even troubled ones.
3 times the physical abuse, 2x the sexual abuse in the system meant to protect them.
That's the data presented. The purported protection often seems to lead to greater physical danger. Furthermore, the source cites data showing that children in U.S. foster care have a death rate that's 42% higher than the general child population.
42% higher risk of death.
Yes, 35.4 deaths per 100,000 person years in foster care, compared to 25.0 per 100,000 in the general population.
That is deeply counterintuitive and just heartbreaking. The state's intervention, designed to secure the child's life and well-being, seems to statistically increase the risk of death and serious harm, according to this data.
And the long-term societal costs cited are equally severe. Former foster youth face dramatically elevated rates of homelessness, up to 25% for those aging out of the system. Unemployment rates hover over 50% by age 24, and high school completion rates. They're described as abysmal. 58.3% for DCF youth versus 89.2% statewide average in Massachusetts.
Wow.
So the data suggests the state-sponsored solution often creates a pipeline to long-term chronic instability, dependency, and poor life outcomes.
These apparent failures bring us directly to the financial engine of the critique, the Title IV-E program. The source identifies this as the core driver of what it calls a perverse incentive structure.
Right. The federal Title IV-V foster care program, which sits within that non-positive law Title 42 we discussed, it allocates matching funds to states, up to 50%.
Mm.
But it's indexed directly to the headcount of children in state custody. Not outcomes, not reunification rates, headcount.
So the incentive is brutally simple. The more children the state keeps in custody, the more federal money flows in. The funding mechanism itself subsidizes custodial retention, not necessarily family reunification or well-being.
Exactly. That's the core of the critique's financial argument. In Massachusetts, the per-child costs in foster care were averaging approximately $4,000 a month. That translates to annual expenditures exceeding $48,000 per child when you include overhead and administrative costs.
$48,000 per child per year.
And the state receives millions based on maintaining a high census of kids in care. In FY 2023 alone, Massachusetts reportedly claimed over $200 million in these federal reimbursements.
Okay, so if the system is designed, intentionally or not, to reward headcount retention, how clean are those financial practices? Are they dotting all the I's?
Well, federal oversight reports cited reveal significant financial vulnerabilities. Audits have documented error rates as high as 40% in eligibility determinations for Title and U funding.
40% error rate.
Up to 40% in some reports, meaning that a massive amount of federal funding, potentially tens of millions of dollars, was claimed for cases that may not have even technically qualified under the program's own rules.
That suggests, at minimum, mismanagement and potentially systemic exploitation of the funding mechanism just to sustain the apparatus.
That's the implication drawn. And this feeds directly into what the source calls the institutional symbiosis. Basically, a closed ecosystem where various professional actors have a vested financial interest in prolonged custody battles.
Explain that symbiosis. What does it look like on the ground?
We see this interlocking network described involving guardians ad litem, or GALs, and DCF-approved therapeutic providers. GALs are often appointed by the court, supposedly to represent the child's best interest. But the source points out that many GALs are also affiliated with or heavily rely on referrals from the DCF system itself.
Okay, so you have a GAL whose high hourly billing, sometimes ranging from $150 to $300 an hour, is directly dependent on how long and how complex the case is.
Precisely. The argument is they have an incentive to prolong custody through iterative, detailed reports. And the GAL recommendations often cite the need for therapy or evaluations, which must then be provided by DCF-approved, often high-billing therapists.
Ah, I see. It creates a circular flow.
It creates a circular revenue model, according to the critique. The GAL recommends therapy. The DCF-referred therapist writes reports that justify prolonged custody. The GAL writes more reports based on that. And the system continues to bill taxpayers or insurance or the state for all these services. It ensures family dissolution becomes a revenue generator for the administrative and legal professionals involved.
That seems like the ultimate conflict of interest. The very people tasked with determining whether a child should be reunified with their family are financially rewarded only if the case remains open, complex, and prolonged.
So to move beyond the sort of dry statistics and financial schemes, the source provides the Rivera case. It's presented as the operational blueprint, a detailed timeline illustrating how these systemic constitutional violations allegedly play out in a real-life case. It starts with a lawful medical choice that then spirals into what the source describes as a state-sanctioned abduction.
Okay, let's walk through this timeline carefully, keeping that constitutional focus that the source demands. The saga begins on February 18th, 2025. What happens?
The predicate act. A physician files a 51A report alleging medical neglect. The sole basis. The parents refused a vitamin K injection for their newborn. Now, this is a non-mandatory procedure, and the source notes it even has an FDA black box warning. Importantly, the child was reportedly perfectly healthy, born with an Apgar score of 9, normal discharge.
So, the violation alleged here is key. The immediate invocation of state power, the threat of deprivation of liberty, based on no actual harm, only a hypothetical risk related to refusing an optional procedure. The source argues this violates Articles 12 and 14 of the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights deprivation without oath or warrant. And it invokes that maxim nullum crimen sine injuria, no crime without an actual injury.
Exactly. Where there's no injury, there can be no crime, and thus no legitimate state intervention, according to this principle. But the escalation apparently starts immediately. 2 days later, February 20th, DCF agents arrive at the family's home without a warrant. They demand entry, and they demand the parents sign a safety plan. The source calls this the second intrusion.
And when the parents refused entry, which is their right without a warrant,
the alleged harassment began. The source claims 18 phone calls were made to the family and their relatives over the next 2 weeks, even after receiving written refusals to engage without counsel or court order.
Okay, so this pressure, this action, the source argues, violates Article 14, the right to be secure in one's home against unreasonable search, and also Article 12, the right against compelled self-incrimination. They're pressuring the parents to comply and provide information without any lawful order.
Right. Now, fearing imminent unlawful seizure of their children, because remember, no custody order existed at this point, the Riveras fled Massachusetts for Texas on March 5th. The source frames this as them exercising their fundamental right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, which is guaranteed by Article 1 of the MA Declaration of Rights.
But fleeing the state then triggered cross-state involvement, didn't it?
It did. Texas authorities arrested the father on March 8th for custodial kidnapping.
Kidnapping. But Massachusetts didn't have lawful custody yet.
Exactly. That's the point the source hammers.
Yeah.
Massachusetts had not secured a lawful custody order before the family left the state. So the source labels this arrest a clear example of police power being improperly used to enforce an administrative demand that lacked judicial backing at the time.
And then comes the dramatic, highly aggressive seizure of the children on March 10th.
Yes. The raid. It reportedly happened at 2 a.m. 15 to 20 officers raided the motel room where the mother and children were staying. The children were removed, allegedly at gunpoint.
At gunpoint, for refusing vitamin K.
That's the sequence described.
Mm-hmm.
This is cited as a massive breach of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and Article E's way of the MA Declaration of Rights, an unreasonable seizure conducted without a lawful presented warrant for removal at that moment.
The trauma of a 2 a.m. raid like that. The source suggests this is a direct consequence of DCF choosing to pursue the parents outside of the proper judicial process initially. It created this chaotic, dangerous scenario that seems vastly disproportionate to the initial issue, the non-mandatory vitamin K refusal.
And the alleged coercion didn't end with the seizure. Upon transporting the infant back to Massachusetts, the child was reportedly forcibly vaccinated against the mother's explicit written religious objection. The source claims the mother was told directly, no shot, no access to baby. A clear violation, it argues, of religious liberty under Article 2 of the MA Declaration.
This is just layer upon layer. And this brings us to the legal maneuver that the source describes with the term retroactive fabrication, the issuance of the ex parte order.
Yes. The juvenile court issued the actual custody order on March 12, 2025. That's after the children had already been seized in Texas, transported across state lines, and the infant forcibly vaccinated against the parents' will.
After the fact.
After the fact.
Yeah.
And the order was issued ex parte, which means without the parents being present or even properly notified to argue their case. The source calls this a brazen attempt to legally paper over the prior illegal seizure, violating Article X, the right to due process, the right to be heard before deprivation.
They essentially legalized the abduction 2 days after it happened, according to this account.
That's the strong claim made. And the human cost of this alleged legal aggression is immense. 7 months later, as of the source's writing in October 2025, the family remained fractured. This was despite the mother having reportedly been acquitted of all criminal charges related to the initial allegations.
Acquitted, but still fighting for her children.
Yes. The source analyzed the entire chronology and calculated what it claims are 2,509 distinct violations across 26 separate articles of the Massachusetts Declaration of Rights in this one case. The Rivera chronology, the source concludes, serves as the ultimate proof of systemic constitutional nullification in practice. So given this whole indictment, the argument about constitutional nullity from the start, the perverse financial incentives rewarding family fracture, and these systemic documented violations in cases like the Rivera families, the source concludes that incremental reform is simply structurally and legally impossible. It won't work.
The argument is that the system's very architecture is constitutionally incompatible with a free people. Why exactly is reform seen as impossible, according to this critique? What's the barrier?
Well, because the core incentives identified, specifically Title IV-E's funding formula rewarding headcount, and that institutional symbiosis that basically commodifies child removal, these can't be simply legislated away with minor tweaks, the argument goes. They are so fundamental to how the system operates that any attempt at reform would likely be captured and subverted by the existing structure. The source insists the state relies on this built-in conflict of interest, and just changing minor rules won't fix the fundamental financial reward system.
The critique also seems to focus quite a bit on the role of the judiciary in perpetuating this, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. The source argues that oversight bodies, and even judges, who rely on or become entangled with this system's revenue model, for instance, by consistently approving GAL appointments and the associated billing, can effectively become accessories to injustice. Yeah. They end up rubber stamping actions that the source claims are void from the start. There's a structural inability, perhaps, to hold the system truly accountable when they are part of its mechanics.
And legal history itself seems to dictate a much more severe approach to unconstitutional actions than just trying to modify them.
Absolutely. The source invokes the major precedent of Marbur v. Madison from 1803. That case established the principle that an unconstitutional act is void ab initio void from the beginning. And the remedy is nullification, striking it down entirely, not just tinkering with it.
So you don't reform something that was never lawful to begin with?
That's the idea. Furthermore, they cite the recent Loper-Bright Enterprises v. Raimondo ruling, which ended Chevron deference. That was the legal doctrine that historically required courts to defer to administrative agencies' interpretations of ambiguous statutes. Ending Chevron deference removes that presumption of power from unelected administrators, which the source argues further justifies the necessary excision, as they put it, of the entire administrative apparatus deemed unconstitutional.
So the source argues for total abolition, complete dismantling. But practically speaking, if you abolish DCF entirely tomorrow, what immediate mechanism steps in to protect a child who is facing immediate objective physical violence tonight? Does the source address that critical gap?
It does. The source insists that the authority must revert immediately to the existing Republican framework, which relies on disinterested parties and strict constitutional due process. This means removal decisions would require a sworn petition, likely vetted by a grand jury, and then adjudicated by a jury of peers before a genuinely disinterested judge, not an administrative hearing.
Back to the courts, with a much higher burden of proof.
Yes, and crucially, the threshold for action immediately reverts to that objective corporal injury standard, actual provable harm or imminent threat.
Okay, so that dramatically raises the legal barrier for state intervention, ensuring action is only taken for provable, necessary protection, not subjective concerns.
And they also point to successful alternatives that are already operating within the U.S. Things like community-based councils used effectively in some Amish settlements and Native American tribes. These structures, the source suggests, prioritize internal family cohesion, restorative justice, community support, over bureaucratic perpetuation and financial quotas. The state's role would become limited, perhaps supporting these local restorative systems rather than acting as the primary administrative entity itself.
So the solution proposed then is really a return to sovereignty, the people's sovereignty, and strict adherence to the checks and balances of a government of laws, not of unchecked administrative power.
That is the ultimate conclusion presented. The legislature cannot delegate powers to an unelected administrative agency that it could not itself lawfully seize in the first place. And since the argument is that the power over fundamental parental rights was never delegated by the people to the legislature, the agency created to exercise that power must therefore be dismantled as unlawful.
Okay, let's try to synthesize this. This deep dive has shown that the indictment against CPS, particularly as argued in the source material regarding MADCF, is really a powerful three-pronged legal argument. One, the system is potentially devoid of original constitutional delegation. Two, it's fueled by what's described as a corrosive financial machinery in Title IV-E that incentivizes keeping kids in care. And three, its alleged lack of lawful authority is demonstrated through systemic violations, starkly illustrated in cases like the Rivera family's ordeal.
And the source notes, quite chillingly, that the evidence presented here is likely only the tip of the iceberg. They reference recent revelations emerging in places like Tennessee, suggesting this system's machinery might be being exploited for purposes far outside legitimate child welfare, potentially even facilitating unlawful migration pathways. This suggests the structural failure isn't just isolated to Massachusetts, but could be systemic across the nation, wherever this particular model is adopted.
Wow. That raises an important final question then, doesn't it? The source concludes, quite bluntly, that CPS never existed lawfully and operates essentially as a criminal cartel in daylight. If the government exists solely to secure liberty and life as the foundational principle state, what then is the duty of the citizenry when the very apparatus designed, supposedly, to protect them becomes, in this view, the primary agent of usurpation, an agent demanding not palliation, not reform, but extirpation, complete removal?
That's a heavy question.
It is. The critique demands we ask not how to fine-tune the system, but why we allow a system potentially devoid of constitutional authority, fueled by perverse financial incentives, to continue operating in the first place. That is definitely something for you to mull over.